All right. Good afternoon. Thank you guys all for coming out this afternoon. I actually thought everyone was going to be moving on to dinner and drinks and things like that. Always the last session of the day is hit or miss. So I really appreciate everyone taking the time to come here. My name is Craig Kitterman. I'm a product manager on the Windows Azure product marketing team. And today I'm going to talk to you a little bit about the cloud services of Windows Azure. And really, how to get started with cloud services. This is an introductory session. So if you're expecting, you know, a super deep dive, this isn't the right session for you. This is very much an introductory session. And so we're going to talk about how to develop apps using the cloud services model, some of the cool things you can do with it. And then we're going to talk about some of the general sort of architectural principles that you need to keep in mind when building and designing applications for the cloud. I imagine many of you today are building, you know, on-premises applications, some WinForm stuff, some web stuff. And there's a few different things you need to keep in mind to really take advantage of and get the full capability of what the public cloud has to offer. So with that, let's dive in. So what is the cloud? I always start with this question because you probably have heard 100 different people answer this question 100 different ways. And if you believe some of the hype, it's probably something like this, right? Of course, that's not the case. As much as I wish it were, it's not the case. So let's take a practical look at when we're talking about cloud, what are the types of things that we're actually talking about? What are the services that we're talking about delivering? So here's some more buzzwords for you. IaaS, PaaS, and SaaS. IaaS is infrastructure as a service. This is the very simple notion of being able to get virtual machines on demand from somebody else in the cloud. Instead of provisioning those things on your own infrastructure in your own data center, you spin those up on a third party's infrastructure. In the case of Windows Azure, you go through the Windows Azure portal and you request a new virtual machine from Microsoft. That virtual machine gets provisioned in our data center and you're handed an IP address as an endpoint. You can connect to that machine, install what you want, do what you want with it. It's yours. It's just running in our data center. That's infrastructure as a service. Platform as a service, which is what we're going to talk about primarily today, is the notion of going a little bit further up the stack, where you're not thinking about things like the operating system and configuring the runtime for that thing, patching and managing all the security updates and so on. That's what you have to deal with when you're dealing with a normal physical machine, and that's what you're also having to deal with when you're dealing with infrastructure as a service. And platform as a service, the vendor who's providing you that platform service capability actually does all that stuff for you. So you don't have to think about security updates or updating your runtime or any of that stuff. It's all done for you. And what you get instead as a developer is a container, a set of APIs that you can hook your app into and that you know are going to be there and are going to run. And so then you write your code and you deploy your code as a unit and you don't have to worry about any of the other stuff. Okay, that's the platform as a service model. And of course, SaaS. Applications delivered to you as finished services, typically through a browser or through some kind of device. We're all familiar with those. So today we're going to talk primarily about infrastructure as a service and platform as a service. We're going to focus on platform as a service because that's the focus of the talk, but we will touch on infrastructure as a service as well. So what can it do for you? You're all here probably because you haven't yet played with the cloud much, and you're wondering, okay, what can it actually do for me? Why am I here? Well, the first thing is agility. Early on when we were talking about cloud, the notion of cost came up a lot. What does it mean in terms of cost? There are a lot of cost advantages to doing certain things in the cloud. But the primary benefit, particularly for developers, is agility. Imagine not having to wait around for infrastructure to be provisioned, for you to be able to go spin up your own development and test environment on demand when you need it, get the resources you want, run your tests, run your code, test your code, spin those things back down without having to talk to anyone. You know, I heard a horror story from a developer a few weeks ago. He has to send a fax to somebody to get a server provision so he can run his tests. I didn't even know fax machines still existed. Okay, but that's a reality for some people, particularly in larger, legacy type of enterprise companies. So having that agility, being able to do what you want to do and being empowered as a developer to get your work done quicker and easier. Okay? The other great thing is you don't have to reinvent the wheel. How many times have you written like identity authorization code or you know, certain bits of your storage code, writing data to and from a database. There's a lot of types of code that we as developers have to write over and over and over. It seems like we have to write over and over again. You know, as the tools have matured, as the frameworks have matured, that's gotten better, I think. But there's still a lot of things. Like identity provider is actually a good example. How many of you in the room have implemented like the Facebook or Twitter APIs? Few. I did it about 5 years ago when it was pretty early on, and it was really painful. I had to go learn OAuth and all this other stuff. Well, guess what? Lots of other people have already written that code. Why can't I just use that? So the great thing about cloud providers who provide platform as a service and other types of services is that that code's been written. There's an API that you can just call in order to add that capability to your app. And we'll talk a little bit more about that. This particular caveman loves APIs, so. So these application building blocks are a core part of building cloud service applications. It's not just, you know, your web code or your service code. It's all the other stuff that you can hook into very easily with standard APIs. So, you know, things like big data, database on demand, rather than going having to provision servers and configure SQL Server, another thing I, as a developer, never used to like to do is go set up the database server. Instead, now I can, with a few clicks, get a database and a connection string, and I'm off and running. That's what I want to, you know, I want to spend my time on the app, not on provisioning stuff. Storage systems that are non-relational, key-value stores, NoSQL, if you will. Being able to configure caching, identity, implementing identity providers in my app. If I want to accept Twitter identities, I want to accept Facebook, Google IDs, Yahoo IDs, all of that stuff is available to me by just writing a few lines of code, dropping that in my app, and now I can accept those providers as identity providers for my application without having to go understand OAuth token exchange protocol. So that's the power of these building block services. The other core tenant of cloud, and you heard a lot about this morning with the announcement of the per-minute billing now on Windows Azure, is paying only for what you use. Again, this is a powerful construct, particularly as developers who are going to be using this infrastructure potentially for short bursts of time. There's no need for your dev environment, for example, to be running all night while you're asleep. So you can shut that thing down before you leave, either through a browser experience or with a script. And you're only paying for what you use. And in fact, if you're an MSDN subscriber, you're probably not paying anything extra for that. So that's really a core tenet of cloud, self-service agility and paying only for what you use. In the traditional model, when you were going to buy infrastructure for an application, somebody had to make a somewhat educated decision about how many servers do we actually need to service our customers or our expected load for this app. And one thing's for certain, they guessed wrong. It's always wrong. They either wasted capital expense by buying too much hardware for fear of not being able to service their customers, or they bought not enough hardware and they were underserving their customers. It's always wrong. So being able to match that demand curve in the cloud by spinning things up and spinning things down as that demand curve fluctuates, which it does, really gives you a lot of agility and cost benefit and paying only for what you use. Okay? So now let's dig into Windows Azure and talk a little bit about Windows Azure's implementation of platform as a service in what we call cloud services. Let's talk first about the global infrastructure. So under all of these great cloud services, the compute models, these application building blocks, we have a bunch of physical hardware. Windows Azure has 10 data centers today, and we're growing, distributed around the world. And everybody always asks me, you know, what's it look like in one of these data centers? So I actually wanted to show you a little picture about what it actually looks like in there. These are container-based systems, very modular. There's hundreds of servers in each one of these things and switches and networking gear. They're wheeled into place by tiny, strong men and hooked up to all their respective utilities. They get plugged into power, water for cooling, and network. You can see like the pipes there. And that's about it. These are complete lights-out operations. Nobody ever goes inside those sealed containers. Basically, we wait until you know the stuff inside has sort of decayed or failed to a certain unacceptable level. And then we take those things out and put in a new one and the old one gets refurbished. So that's how we operate these data centers. They're operated by the same folks that run all of the Microsoft Finished Services, MSN, Hotmail, Office 365, and the like. So they really know how to do this. And this modular operation gives us a lot of benefit in terms of scalability, but also economic benefit that makes things better for you as the user of Windows Azure. So now let's talk about platform as a service and Windows Azure's implementation of that, which is called cloud services. It allows you to build infinitely scalable apps and systems. That means is you can compose apps of multiple different tiers using what we call roles, and we'll get into that in a minute. And automated application management, this is an important concept, particularly in platform as a service. What happens automatically, the Windows Azure Fabric is always looking and monitoring your application as it runs and making sure that it's in a healthy state. And if it's not in a healthy state, it actually handles fixing that for you in many cases. So let's take a look at how this actually works. So we start by building an application. Let's just say we have a simple web application, ASP.NET web application. And we build that thing in Visual Studio just like we always have, but the difference is now we upload what's called a service package into Windows Azure. And this can be done through a browser. It can also be done directly from Visual Studio, and I'll show you the Visual Studio method. That service package is nothing more than a glorified zip file. It contains the code for your app. So if it's a web app, it's your, you know, your ASPX files and all your images and whatnot. And it can contain some configuration metadata, and that configuration metadata simply tells Windows Azure how to run your application. Now, if you just want to run a .NET app, like an ASP.NET application, you don't have to set up really any special configuration information. Windows Azure already has .NET configured in that container by default. And your app gets uploaded, it gets deployed, and everything's done. You can put special configuration data in there to install special software. You can have a startup script that does anything and configures the runtime any way you like it. So there's a lot of flexibility here in terms of what you can deploy. So once Windows Azure takes that service package, it first looks at the configuration data and says, how many instances of your app do you want? And an instance, at the end of the day, represents one virtual machine. So it's simply a number in a configuration file. I can say one, I can say four. In this case, I said I want four instances of my app. Windows Azure reads that data and says, OK, I'm going to go provision you four virtual machines somewhere in this massive data center that you've chosen. Get them all ready with the latest guest operating system. Make sure it's all patched and up to date with all the latest goodies. And then we're going to, the next phase is we're going to actually put your code on those four VMs in a very, very consistent way. Sorry, I'm getting too far from the receiver. So now we have four virtual machines that have exactly the same bits on them that are running our app. Okay? But that's not enough because now nobody can access our app. It's running on VMs in a data center somewhere. Last thing that happens, Windows Azure automatically sets up network load balancing across those four instances that I've requested. So all the inbound requests to my my website in this case get equally distributed across those four instances. Okay? Now, when something bad happens, one of these VMs goes down because some underlying infrastructure failed, which it does, it will. Windows Azure automatically detects that that instance is down, goes and re-images a brand new VM, and then adds that one to the load balancer. So this can happen in the middle of the night. If anybody here has ever received a page, you know, late at night or in the middle of the night because a hard drive failed on a production machine or something like that, you'll understand how important this is. You may not ever even know that happened. You probably won't unless you set up, you know, alerts to get told when this happens, but it happens automatically. That's the beauty of this model. You don't have to think about those kinds of things. Okay? Now, our website just got really popular. And you know, it's on Oprah's favorite things or something like that. We need to scale, and we need to scale fast. So I can go into Windows Azure, and that should be four, not two, but I can go into Windows Azure now, and all I need to do is literally drag a slider bar from four, or in this case two, up to however many instances I think I need to handle the spike in traffic. So all I do is drag that slider bar, in this case six, we click save, and Windows Azure starts provisioning more VMs, imaging them with our code, and getting them on the load balancer. Now this thing explodes and becomes viral on the internet, and I need way more than that. I simply drag that slider bar up to 92 or what have you, and Windows Azure does the same thing. There's no difference. It goes out, provisions 92 more VMs, and in just a few minutes, I've got load balanced traffic across 92 VMs with a slider bar. So that's the power of scalability of this model. Walking too much. And when the buzz dies down, which it will, you know, Oprah's buzz died off, and I don't need all those 92 VMs anymore. Drag the slider bar back down. I have some new customers that I didn't have before, so now I need 10 instead of, you know, 4 or 6, but I don't need 92, okay? So the other cool thing that we added to Windows Azure Cloud Services recently is the ability to add a cache to your roles, if it will, your instances. So you can have a distributed cache that is shared across multiple instances. So in the case of where I have 4 instances of my app, I can say I want 300 megabytes of each of those instances to be in a shared cache. So effectively, I have a 1.2 gig cache that's shared by all my instances. But in terms of the underlying use of resources on each VM, I'm only using 300 megabytes. You could also set it up such that you have dedicated cache roles where you basically, the underlying infrastructure provisions just dedicated VMs for your cache, and then all your instances of your app just talk to that cache. And this is a really simple thing to set up. And I'll show you really quick how to configure that as well. And then you can scale that out as well. If you want more cache, you just simply scale it out, and then everything just still works the way it worked before. Again, it's about focusing on the apps. Your developers, you don't want to focus on infrastructure. Let's focus on apps. And what does that really mean? It means focusing on business, delivering business value, because you, the developer, the expert, who knows how to write the business logic for the app, is not spending time doing things that you ought not be doing. And at the end of the day, that's what's important, right, is that the business is successful, you're successful, everybody's happy, okay? I'm not going to go too much into this. This is something for probably another talk if you want to go off and do some other deeper talks. There's a lot of different services that are available on Windows Azure here, including the building block services that I talked about, which are sort of the green boxes on top. Those are the things you can hook in with simple APIs to your app. We also have a bunch of other more infrastructure or core services, let's call them, for hosting and running apps. Storage systems. We have a relational database store, a SQL database. We have a non-relational store, as I mentioned. We have virtual machines. We have cloud services, which we're going to talk about today. We also have something about websites, and I do want to hit on websites for just a second. So if you've looked at all at the Windows Azure offering, we have something called WebRoll, which is what we're going to look at today, and we have something called Websites. And it can be confusing in terms of which does which. WebRoll was introduced first, and it's designed for enterprise, cloud scale, types of applications that are multi-tier and complicated deployments and whatnot. And Websites was initially designed to really get up and running quickly. It allows you to deploy even faster than with cloud services, run some different types of languages and runtimes out of the gate, like PHP and Node.js and some other things. It gives you some of the scalability benefits, but not all the same benefits. So if you hear people tossing about WebRoll versus Websites, they're two different offerings. They can both run a website, but they have different benefits and capabilities. So just real quick, when we're talking about WebRoll here, which is what we're going to cover, we have a lot of capabilities that Websites doesn't have. We have environments for staging and production. So when you deploy that service package up into the cloud, you can say, I want that to go into a staging bucket, or I want that to go into the production bucket. With cloud services, you get this. And what's really cool about it is you can deploy up into the cloud into a staging bucket. It will give you back a URL that has some funny GUID on the front, so it's effectively nobody can find it. You click on that, you can run all your smoke tests and all your final testing before you roll that into production. And then when you roll it into production, you click a button and it literally does a virtual IP swap between staging and production. And what was in production goes to staging, what was in staging goes to production. So it's a very easy way to test your app before you go into production. Websites doesn't really give you that. Once you deploy, it's just like sort of more of a traditional hosting model in that once you deploy, you write your files out there. That's what's in production. So there's no sort of final backup button. The great thing about this sort of switchover thing is when you roll something into production and then you realize there's an issue, you can click the button again and it goes back. So the old build goes back into production and then you can go figure out what's going on. It's happened to me several times, so it's a really nice feature. One of the other things you can do with a web role that you can't do with websites is actually remote desktop into the underlying VM. Now, in a perfect, pure platform as a service world, you would never want to do that because you shouldn't be bothered with such things as operating systems and whatnot. But if you're trying to configure your startup script because you have some complicated software or something that needs to get installed on your underlying instance VMs, you may want to RDP in there just to take a peek and make sure everything got configured properly so you know your startup script works. So it just gives you a little bit of control to peek under the covers when you need to, but you would never actually RDP or remote desktop in and then install a bunch of stuff because then it would immediately be blown away because a web role is stateless. It doesn't persist everything to disk, so everything needs to be configured within your startup script. Let's see, there's a few other things. The virtual networking support is the next most important, and then we'll move on. This is the ability to create virtual networks in the cloud. You may have already heard we have this capability in Azure. And you can even connect those virtual networks that you create in the cloud back with your existing on-premises infrastructure, your existing data center. So you can provision new services in the cloud that can talk over LAN IPs to your existing stuff. You can do that now with cloud services. With websites, you can't. Websites is basically, if you just have a website with a database, it's great. But if you need some of these more complicated services, web roles for you. Okay, so now that we've got that out of the way, let's take a look at how to build one of these things. I got to switch back over here. Everyone still awake? All right. All right, if I can log into my machine, which I cannot. All right, we're in Visual Studio 2012. I've got the Windows Azure SDK installed. It's a very easy thing to install. A Windows Azure Dev Center, just go there and click the thing, it'll run the web platform installer. And get you all set up and get your VS configured. Once you have that, it's very easy to create a new cloud service project. So let's do that. File, new project. And under whatever language you prefer, I prefer C Sharp, I'm going to select cloud. And you'll see here Windows Azure Cloud Service. And let's just call this one breakout sample. OK. And I have the normal ability to add source control or do anything else you can with a normal VS project. So now, what this is going to do is actually create sort of a shell for my cloud service project, which is really the bit that holds that configuration data. What separates a regular web application from a cloud application is that, remember, that extra configuration data that's in the service package. So, but what it's asking me for now is, okay, we're going to go create that configuration shell for you, but what type of code do you actually want us to run? And there's two types of code you can run in a Windows Azure Cloud Service. You can run a web role, which is effectively an IIS-based workload, a website. Or you can run what's called a worker role, which is basically more like a Windows service. There's basically a loop, a while loop that loops forever, that allows you to do things in the background asynchronously. And I'll show you an example of an app that does that in a few minutes. So for this sample, we're just going to say, I want an ASP.NET MVC4 web role. And that's all I'm going to do for right now. So I'm just going to go through the prompts and create my cloud service. So you'll see here, this is just a normal MVC4 project. And then I have this additional project that's in my solution that has the little cloud here. And that's where all this configuration data is held. So if I click on one of these configuration files, you can see I can set things like global connection strings for my storage account, for my cloud storage account, database connection strings, all that kind of stuff. There's particular app settings I can actually abstract those back out of like web.config and put them in the cloud service config. And what that allows me to do is actually while my service is running in the cloud, I can go up into the Windows Azure portal and tweak those configuration values, and then the next time the code comes through, it'll pick up the latest one from the service config, and I don't need to redeploy. So it's just a nice place to store configuration data. And you'll see here, this is the important one. Sorry, let me zoom this in. That's probably terrible. You'll see here this instance is count equals one. That just tells them, again, how many underlying VMs do you want this thing to run on? So I'm going to go ahead and just make this 4 for the purposes of this exercise. And then we're going to just go ahead and do F5 here. Was there like a subway under this room? Whoa. And what you're going to see is not particularly exciting, but I'll explain to you why it's not exciting. So this is your standard ASP.NET MVC 4 thing. Woohoo! There's no difference here, except for there is. This thing's actually running inside the Windows Azure emulator. So let's take a look at what that looks like. So what we have here is a tiny piece of software that runs on your local machine that emulates what's going to happen when that thing gets deployed to the real cloud. And that includes both the runtime container for your application, as well as storage. So like if you're using table storage or using queues, basically we have simulated the storage APIs from the cloud as well. So you can test how your app's going to behave when it goes into production right on your local machine using local storage. And actually backs the storage APIs with SQL, but you don't need to know that. It just works. Okay. And the interesting bit here is when I expand this, it should have gone to 4. Maybe I didn't change something right. Normally this would have 0, 1, 2, 3 and deploy all 4 of the VMs. So let me try that again. Maybe I didn't save something. Oh, I know. I need to change it in this file. So let's try that again. See, I have a cloud. I have two configuration files here. One is my local version, and one is my cloud version. And I said in my cloud version, which is what it gets read when you actually deploy to the cloud, I want 4 instances. But I failed to change the 4 on my local version. So when I run it locally, I also want 4 versions. So now, if we go back into the Windows Azure emulator, I should see 4 instances there. So I actually have 4, tiny runtime containers, if you will, running in parallel. And every inbound request that I make to this IP is going to get load balanced across those 4 instances. And I have sort of like a debug console here for each of these. So if I have a lot of inter-process, inter-role communication and other things going on, I can spew debug to these windows and try to understand what's going on if something strange is happening. So that's what's kind of cool about being able to run that on your local machine. And then the other part is simulating those storage APIs. All right, so net takeaway from this, it's really no different than building a normal application in terms of getting it configured, except for just starting with a cloud service project. Now, you can do something else, which is you can create a cloud service in Visual Studio, and then you can add to it an existing project application. So you don't need to do it exactly the way I did, which is create a fresh one. You can add an existing web app. And your existing web app needs to behave itself a little bit. And we'll talk a little bit more about what I mean by that. There's some specific concepts. But let's look at a slightly more advanced app that uses some more of the capabilities of cloud services. So let's just close this guy and open this guy. All right. So let's run it first. Now you'll notice that this app has a web role and a worker role in it. And we'll take a look at both of those pieces. The only thing is when you're doing your debug and you're F5 all the time, it does take a little bit longer to start when you're running in the Azure emulator because it actually has to deploy the app if it were to Windows Azure emulator and have it start up. It starts a lot quicker than it used to, but it still takes a little bit of extra time. All right, so we have a very simple guestbook app here, very simple form on it, and I'll show you what it does. It's really not complicated. So I'm going to assign the guestbook, and I'll put a picture in there, and I'll assign it. Now you'll notice I'm uploading a picture. And you'll notice what happens is when the picture gets initially uploaded, it's a pretty big picture. Someday, oh. JavaScript error. What's JavaScript? Just kidding. Let's try this one more time. Let's do a fresh build. Let's try that again. Random. Okay, so there's this big picture here, which for some reason, now the picture's not rendering all the way. But it uploads a picture, and it's really huge and ridiculous. And you'll see in just a few moments here, if everything is working properly, that I have an asynchronous process running in a worker role that's out sniffing my storage account for guestbook entries that just arrived. And it's going to grab the image and actually make a thumbnail out of it and then republish it back into the course. Here, I can actually run this thing from the cloud. Let's just quit messing around here. So I have a version of this. I have a version of this app running in the cloud that's pointing to the same storage account in the cloud. So all it does is takes that image, uploads it, puts a message on a messaging queue through a simple API call, which I'll show you, and then I have that worker role that's just spinning in that continuous loop. The worker role's only job is to go check that queue and see if there's any work to be done. If there's work to be done, it goes over and grabs the image and makes a thumbnail out of it, and then changes the pointer. Okay, so I can real easily add a few more, and we'll hopefully it'll work a little bit quicker this time. Bill says yo. Going and picking up that queue, resizing, and then there's actually long polling going on in the client. You see that, how it just automatically refreshes? Long polling going on to check the image, and then it grabs a new one. Very simple app, nothing exciting, super ugly UI, my apologies for that, but it serves a point, which is it's super easy to get that kind of asynchronous capability to your apps. So I remember the days of doing password resets where you would click, reset my password, and then the thing would spin for like 30 seconds while something's going on, which is kind of silly. Now, with this capability, I can easily just add a worker role and use a queue and say, hey, Windows Azure queues, go reset this person's password and send them an email when you get around to it. And then the UI can come right back, it won't block. Comes right back to the user and says, your password email will be sent to you momentarily, right? And then that worker role comes and picks it up off the queue and does something with it. It's a very simple construct, and it used to be kind of complicated because you'd have to go write Windows services, and I don't know how many folks in the room have written Windows services. It can be painful at times. But with this worker role construct, effectively I have one file here when I create a worker role. It's called workerrole.cs. And in there, I have I have this while true, and it just loops forever. And I can do whatever I want there. So let's look at what actually happens when we upload something to the web app. Default. All right, so the first thing that I'm doing when I save that guestbook entry is I'm going to upload the image to my storage account. In this case, I'm using Windows Azure Blob Storage. And with just a few lines of code, basically I can create a new blob and upload from the stream to Blob Storage. So that's what, 5 lines of code to do that. And that's actually going out. In this case, I have it configured just pointed directly to my cloud storage account. I could also emulate this locally and store these things locally. But I'm actually just pushing them right out to the cloud storage account. The second thing I'm doing is creating a guestbook entry here. And this is using Windows Azure Tables. So this is that key value service that I talked about. And the third thing is I'm putting a message on the queue with the data about the guestbook person that just entered their entry. It's really simple, few lines of code, a lot less than doing something with a relational database probably. And now there's something sitting on the code. So now there's an image in Blob Storage, there's an entry with the other metadata in Table Storage, and then there's something in the queue. So there's 3 different Windows Azure services that are available to you in the storage system that are available over the simple APIs. Now, let's look at the worker role and see what the worker role does. So the worker role basically comes in and says, get a message off the queue. And there's some other code down here which will actually dequeue the message. And then basically parse it. So there's multiple different parts that we put in that message. You can construct the message however you want. Basically serialize an object into that queue message. You can do lots of different things. In this case, it's a pretty simple structure, and so we basically parse that queue message back into its components so we know what to do. And then we go and we process the actual code to do the thumbnail resizing. And then this thing just goes down here, and it sleeps. So it just sleeps for 10 seconds, this while loop thread. And then it wakes up again and checks the queue again. Anything for me now? If not, it goes back to sleep and just does that over and over and over again. So you could put a bunch of different code in here that does a bunch of different things every 10 seconds or every 20 seconds or every whatever. You can split it out into multiple worker roles doing different jobs if the load is pretty heavy and you know it's not all going to be able to be done by one, you know, moderately sized virtual machine. The other thing is you can change the size of the underlying VM that is actually running your web role or your worker role. You can make them huge with 12 gigs of RAM and multiple cores, or you can make them really small, you know, with one core and, you know, a gig or two of RAM. You have the control, and then, of course, you're paying based on what size of virtual machine you're consuming and how many of them, but it's all controllable. All right, so let's flip back over here for a few minutes. So it's pretty easy to get started and do some simple things like that using cloud services. Oh, what I didn't show you is deployment. I'm sorry. Now let me flip back over and do the deployment. So once I'm ready to actually publish this thing, all I do is I right-click on the cloud one, the one with the little cloud here, which is the configuration data, and I want to publish that thing. And I'm going to go back here because I want to actually, let's say new. Oh, whoops. So what you actually do is you download from the Windows Azure portal your publish settings. And I'm going to try to do that. Oh, sorry, it's blinking at me over here. So what you do is you click on that little link there, and then you get this file from Windows Azure that contains your publish settings. This is all the information that Visual Studio needs to connect to your account, your subscription, and start publishing services. So I'm just going to download this file to my local machine. And then I go back into Visual Studio, and I say import. And the one I just downloaded was that one. Is it? And I have multiple subscriptions in Windows Azure under that same account. So I pick the one that I want, and then I just click Next. And I pick the cloud service that I want to publish this to. Now, I haven't created the cloud service yet, so I'm going to actually create one by selecting the dropdown. Sorry, my VS is frozen. So while that's going on, let me hop over here, and I can say, I could have gone in here and created a cloud service before. So this is the Windows Azure portal, if you haven't seen it. On the left-hand side are all the different services that are available to you. If I want a new cloud service, I simply click on the cloud service tab, say new. It figures out I probably want a compute thingy, and I probably want a cloud service. And then I can just give it a name, and it figured that out because I was on the cloud services tab. I could select something else and go create a database if I wanted to. It just is trying to guess what I want because that's the tab I was on. So now let's create this thing. And then I can decide where I actually want to deploy that. So as I mentioned, there's multiple data centers around the world. You get to choose where your thing is deployed. You're going to want it close to your customers, of course. You can also deploy to multiple data centers and then set up traffic load balancing over the top of those in some more complicated scenarios. In this case, I'm just going to deploy to central US. I'm going to set up the cloud service in central US. So when I deploy, it will go to central US. Okay, so the cloud service is created. That doesn't take a lot. Again, it's just a container. So now if I can go back here, I need to refresh this because now I actually have a cloud service there that I want to use. I'll just cancel out of this and redo it. Cloud service thingy, that's the one I just created. When I publish, I want it to just go right into production. Who needs testing? Let's just go for it. And then I click publish. It runs another build, runs the tests if I have anything configured, packages up that service package, and uploads it to Windows Azure. And as soon as the service is configured, you can see here's a little log of what's going on. It's uploading the package now. It uploads the package into a storage account and then tells Windows Azure, hey, there's a package over here for you to go pick up. Windows Azure picks that up, starts provisioning the infrastructure, and off you go. It takes about 5 minutes to deploy a cloud service. So that's one of the key differentiators between the cloud service model and the website model. When you deploy to websites, it's instantaneous. When you deploy to cloud services, because it's actually going and building fresh VMs for you under the covers, it takes a little while longer. Websites actually has warm VMs ready to go that it just pulls into the equation. So it's a little bit of a different model. And the reason for that is because with cloud services, you can have your own startup scripts that configure any number of different things, whereas in websites, you just get IIS and you get a couple of other runtimes and that's it. You don't have any control over that stuff. So that's the trade-off that you make there. Yes, sir. You mean when you're deploying into staging versus production?
No, when you're going to production. Like, you just deploy it to production.
Yes.
Production doesn't work yet, right? So you roll the VMs off until...
Oh, good question. Yeah, so we do... it will go offline. It'll go offline once the new one comes on, yes. It's basically what's called a rolling update. So, and say you have four instances of your old one running. It'll update one, and then update the next one, and then update the next one, and the like. And then the sessions that were already in flight will continue until the new ones are all there. Yes, sir. Yep. No, it's using a proprietary software load balancing schema.
So
You know, I don't know. I don't think that the sort of load balancing stuff would be part of that alignment. I don't think it is. That would be pretty unique. So I don't think so. Yes, sir. Great question. So the question is, how would this work with an Oracle database? If I understand correctly, the other thing that I didn't mention about this cloud service model is that because Windows Azure now has infrastructure as a service, you can go provision arbitrary VMs to do whatever you want. You can go create a web role and a worker role in the platform as a service model and still have other applications like Oracle running in a virtual machine that the app talks to, just like you do today. So it would be distinct. You wouldn't do anything with Oracle in this model. You would probably just run it in a VM. You wouldn't try to set up a startup script to deal with Oracle. That'd be really, you know, square peg, round hole type scenario. I would just run the Oracle in a virtual machine and then do your presentation tier, your API tier, whatever, in cloud services, and then you can talk to that database. Oh, if there's Oracle DLL, are they managed DLLs that run in CLR? Then yeah. Okay. Okay, yeah. So you could set up a startup script to configure and appropriately install your DLLs and make them available. You could do that. Yeah, sorry, I misunderstood the question. Okay, so it looks like the thing's up. Let's cross our fingers here. No, it says it's in an unknown state. I think it's still deploying. So anyway, it's that easy. Just deploy from Visual Studio, and then once everything is up here, you can see it's deploying right now, starting the VMs. And you can see I have two. I have a web role and a worker role that are starting up right now. Some instances are ready. Some are starting. So it just, you know, sometimes it takes a little while. So let's go back over here. All right. Now, I mentioned earlier, if you're going to go create a cloud service project and you're going to add some old app to it, you want to make sure your app behaves. And what I mean by that is your app really designed for the cloud? When I drag that slider bar out to 92 to scale up all this infrastructure, is your app going to actually work the way you expect it to work when all of a sudden that traffic's being load balanced across all these instances? That is the question. So, designing cloud apps is a little bit different, and I want to take you through some of sort of the core concepts there. Rule number one, design for scale. I'm pretty sure the manufacturer of that train didn't have that in mind when they built it. So anything can happen, right? I believe so, yeah. So, you know, if somehow it still works, I don't know how, but you need to think about not just how your business behaves today and how your customers behave and what your expectations are, but what can happen in the future if you're wildly successful beyond your imagination. And just take some simple steps in your architecture to make sure that that's ready. And what that means is building your app to be completely stateless. These are stateless VMs in the cloud. They don't persist anything to the disk. So if you write something to the C drive, when that hard drive fails, eventually, which it will, and Windows Azure goes and provisions a new one automatically, it doesn't know what you wrote to the C drive on that virtual machine that's now gone away, because that storage is not persisted. So what this means is, when you're doing things like storage, making sure that data is persisted into a storage service that is available from all the instances of your app. In fact, there's no guarantee when a user gets assigned to one instance of your app from the load balancer, that the next request from that same user is going to get assigned to the same VM. It might actually get bounced over to another one, because maybe some weird failure happened in the middle. You don't want any state on that virtual machine that your user requires to continue their transaction. And so it also means things like session state. You can't store session state in memory on the machine anymore. You need to use a cache. You can use one of the caching models that I described earlier. You can use database. For session state if you want to. There's a few different options there, but you can't store it on the local machine because even though your app might look like it's running fine and it might test fine and everything else, at a certain point when something weird happens or unexpected, that session's going to get blown away and your user's going to be back to square one and their shopping cart's going to go to zero and you're going to lose that sale. So don't do that. Okay? All right. Last Christmas or a couple Christmases ago, I think it was, a year and a half ago, we're all sitting at home watching watching our favorite Christmas movies. This one's mine. And then this happened. Oops. It made big news. You know, when Twitter goes down and you get the fail whale, it's Tuesday, right? When Netflix goes down, people get pissed. But serious. It's not, Netflix doesn't go down. It can't. So it made big news. This is like a big deal, right? Failure happens. In fact, in the cloud is designed, the cloud is built with that in mind. Like when I think about the way that our infrastructure in Windows Azure is designed, it's commodity type infrastructure that has failure rates that are non-trivial. Hard drives fail, networker switches fail, power transformers blow up. Things happen. It will happen, guaranteed. So you have to keep that in mind. You have to design for failure. That means using things like geo-redundancy in your storage schema. No single points of failure in your application. Because sooner or later, those things will happen. The cloud, the great thing about the cloud and platform as a service in particular, is all the tools are there for you to use. All those APIs, geo-redundancy and storage. In Windows Azure, if you want your data is automatically replicated, by the way, in three places in a single data center. So if one hard drive goes down or one of those containers blows up, your data is in two other places in that same data center. And with a click of a checkbox, it will automatically be geo-replicated to another data center more than 500 miles away in case of disaster or something. So there's tools there. Use those tools. Implement those tools. Understand how they work. Understand how if something does happen, get your data back. Because sooner or later, something strange is going to happen. Yes, sir. In most cases, yes, it is. I mean, that's kind of the core tenet. Although strange things have happened before. Obviously, we try to keep those to a minimum. But those services are designed to be failover, geo-redundant, all of those things. So you should be able to trust in those API services. That's a great question. Thank you. So Netflix even is one of the actually poster children. For designing for failure. Let's see how I'm doing on time. They have this awesome thing called Chaos Monkey. Have you guys heard of Chaos Monkey? It's this piece of software that they unleash upon all the Netflix infrastructure, which happens to be running on Amazon AWS, to just go randomly break stuff. And they randomly break stuff in production. Because the only way to really know what's going to happen if something breaks in production is to go break it in production and see what happens. And if it goes down, go fix it and build more resiliency into that model. And so they've done a really, really, really good job of billing for redundancy. That's why Netflix almost never goes down. This was a freak occurrence when it went down. But they really are, they really do a really good job with that. And so look at what they've done. And actually, I think they've open sourced a lot of the libraries and, sort of intellectual property associated with their Chaos Monkey methodology. You can go look at that and see what they've done. If you're building serious enterprise-grade apps, you want to be thinking about those types of things and stand on the shoulders of giants who've already figured out how to do this stuff and go use it. Go use those libraries. I don't know how they work, but I know they're out there. Because you can build a system that is pretty darn close to 100% reliable. It kind of goes back to your question, sir, which is, I can have everything triplicate, quadruplicate, redundant everywhere, but the cost just starts to get astronomical. The more nines you add down there, You know, for every 9, you probably double the cost associated with running that application and managing that application. So you really have to think about what is your business asking of you in terms of service level, and then architect your app smartly. And one way to do that is to decompose by workload. So your app typically does different things. In the case of our silly little guestbook thing here, one part of the app served up a presentation tier where I entered in some data and saved a file. And another part of the app came up and created thumbnails. In a real business scenario, you know, piece A and piece B probably aren't equivalent in terms of their value to the business. Like maybe piece A can never go down. The website can never go down. But the thing that creates the thumbnails, like who cares when that thing runs? If it runs in the middle of the night or whatever, like people aren't waiting around for their thumbnail to be created, except for me. But typically they're not. So how do you decompose the workload and think about how do I deliver the SLA I need for component A and then, you know, maybe do something a little bit cheaper where I don't need that type of service level? So one example would be like if you had a sports API, for example. And this, people hit the sports API to get the latest and greatest scores and updates. Well, during the game, the SLA for that thing is pretty darn close to 100%, right? That cannot go down during a game for live scores and commentary, because that's what people are like watching real time, like, oh my gosh, what's going on with my team? So that thing has to be up. But when there's no game, live scores and commentary doesn't mean anything because there's no game. So it literally can go to zero. And then, you know, all the rest of the time, like basic team player league stats, those things need to be 100%. So if you can sort of tease apart and break those things down, it makes it a lot easier to architect your app smartly, so you're taking advantage of the redundancy and failover capabilities, but only paying appropriately. What the heck was that? My timer? How do I turn it off? It's okay? Sorry. It scared me. All right, rule number 4. Almost done. Design for interoperability. You never know what's going to happen tomorrow. Same with the scalability story. You don't ever know what applications are going to want to consume data from this application, what new types of devices are going to get invented tomorrow. You have to think about future-proofing your apps and your data and design for interoperability. This is true sort of universally, but particularly in the cloud, because everything is becoming more accessible, more programmable, and you want to make sure that you're future-proofing those assets and creating open REST-based API endpoints for things, and being smart about not locking into a particular architecture with particularly the data. Okay, and last but not least, design for operations. You can only improve your application if you know what's going on. Instrument that thing. Use all the tools that are out there. Great stuff like AppDynamics, New Relic, some of the other monitoring tools in the Azure portal, stuff like System Center. Understand what's going on inside your application so you can tune that thing. And it takes a little bit of work on the dev side to do some instrumentation there, but it's going to make life easier for you. It's going to make life easier for your ops folks. And particularly in the cloud, when you're not running that server and it's running out somewhere else, you got to be able to see into that app. So instrument for ops and design for ops. Okay? So those are kind of the key rules. Okay. So let's do a Q&A. Yes, sir. The question is, does Windows Azure support multi-tier applications that use Windows authentication? The answer is yes. Yep, that's a pretty regular scenario that we deal with. Yes, sir. Yeah. It's a great question. It does. It does, except for it's using a lot of the same resources. It's not spinning up the equivalent of a whole virtual machine. It's using the same underlying resources, the same CPU, the same RAM, or whatever. So yes, but not as much as if it was not as much as if you were actually spinning up VMs. Nowhere near the same. Yep. Yes, sir. Yes. Oh, I'm sorry. All right, let's take a look at that. How do you choose the size of VMs that you are going to use here? I'm so sorry, it's here. Sorry, it's somewhere in here. Let me find it. Let me show you that after the talk. It's in one of these config. It's in the it's actually in the configuration for the actual service here, the app. Sorry, let me find that for you after. I'm sorry. I should have shown that. I forgot to look that up. Other questions? Yes.
This isn't on enterprise level, but
yep.
One of the barriers to entry for going to the developer perspective is it's cheaper to use like a VPS hosting company.
Mm-hmm. For website, for just simple websites? Yeah, I mean, I think so. I don't know what you're paying, but we have a pretty competitive offer, particularly on the website stuff. We have a free tier. We have also a reserved tier where you can run up to 100 websites on shared resources that's really competitive. So I can show you what those offers look like after, but I mean, we're getting a good response. People are using it, so they must be seeing price, you know, price value there. Yep, good question. Yes, sir. Can you specify what? I'm sorry. Oh, good question. So on SQL Server, the way the SQL database service works, if you're using the platform as a service SQL service, which is called Windows Azure SQL Database, you don't specify the number of instances. You simply specify that you want this type of database, and it gives you an endpoint, and then it handles all that stuff sort of under the cover. So it's a slightly different model of abstraction from what you get today. What's that?
Unless you're using sharding,
but in which case then you just provision more databases to do your sharding. You have to do that sort of manually. But that's effectively the way you would scale using SQL databases to do sharding and scale out. Yes, sir. Oh, good question. So when you provision your cloud service, Windows Azure will assign you a DNS called whateveryouaskedfor.cloudapp.net. And then you can go and do your A records or your CNAMEs or whatever on top of that, but you get just a default DNS that has to be unique.
So if you have an existing URL,
yeah.
Well-known public,
yes.
How do you map it to?
You go into your DNS records and create a CNAME that maps from your URL, www, whatever, to myapp.cloudapp.net. Yeah. Yes, sir. There's all kinds of plans for better instrumentation across the board. So that's all I can really tell you. But yeah, there's good. You know, right now you can go in there and you can set up New Relic or AppDynamics and get richer real-time data than you can get in the portal. And they have a free tier. If you go to in the Windows Azure portal, you go to the store, you can provision those things, and they have a free tier, which is pretty awesome, actually. But yeah, we're always, you know, looking to get better, more dynamic, quicker information on all the key metrics, and we'll surface more of that in the portal. Did I see something over there? Sorry. Yeah. So you basically say extra small, large, whatever. And it's been a while since I created a cloud service, because I've been using websites, and now I can't remember where that is. So anybody who wants to see that, I'll just come up at the end. But it's just a simple drop-down box where I pick the size of the VM, and then that's gonna have impact on what I end up paying. So I have to figure it out. Yep.
Can you know balance between Azure and your
Great question. The question is, can you load balance between the cloud and your on-prem solution? So we have a service called Traffic Manager, which allows you to load balance across, you know, deployments in different Windows Azure data centers, but not today between Windows Azure and your on-premises environment. You may be able to get a third-party load balancing solution that can do that. I know you can, but you can't use ours for doing that yet. I think so, yeah. Yeah. So there are solutions to do that, but unfortunately, our Traffic Manager product doesn't handle that scenario yet. That's definitely a popular request. So I hope we can do that someday. Yes, sir, right up front. For backup strategies related to the cloud, there's tons of different options. One of the cooler things that we did is acquired a company called Store Simple. Are you familiar with this company? Back in November, and they have this appliance that sits on your LAN and does some really intelligent caching with your data. So files that are accessed a lot, it looks just like a SAN or an AS or whatever, and you just dump data to it, and then it starts putting things in the cloud as they get old, and then as you retrieve them, it brings them back down and does some cool stuff like that. Yep. Oh, I see. So if a user deletes it, I don't think that there's, you'd have to go through Windows Azure support and they'd have to go pull an old version for you. And I don't know how painful that is. That may be painful, which is different than. Yes. Yeah, so what you do is you just create some kind of job that takes a snapshot of all your blobs and puts them somewhere safe. But there's API to do it. I mean, you could do it in a few lines of code practically. But, you know, you think about it's just like any other production. You know, you have a production storage account which has, like, the real images on it. If you want them backed up, you want to, from user error, you want to back them up somewhere else. Now, if one data center goes down, like I said, there's multiple copies of your data, and Windows Azure will automatically restore your data back. But if some user deletes them, it's probably just a more painful process to go through to get it back. In the back there, yeah.
Yeah, so if you've got a multi-tier app, can you scale the different tiers in proportion to each other?
If you've got a multi-tier app, you can definitely scale the various tiers independently of one another. Great question. Yes, great question. So can I automatically scale various tiers of my app when something happens with one tier? So what we've done is in the Windows Azure portal, and maybe I can show you at least the basic monitoring that you get here. And I apologize for using Chrome, but my IE was having some weird network problem. In the dashboard here, you get some, now that's the one I just provisioned, so it's not going to have much. Here's a VM that I had earlier. And you can see what you can get here. That's going to take a while to load. So you get some basic data here in terms of CPU and RAM and other things that should show up on that graph. But this one hasn't been used much. The nice thing is that all of that data is available through APIs. So you can instrument System Center to respond to specific thresholds that you set. We have another piece of code that was put out by Microsoft Patterns and Practices, which is called the Windows Azure Application Scaling Block. And you can configure it in a number of different ways to set thresholds. If my CPU utilization goes above 65 across all of my instances for more than 5 minutes, add another instance. If it drops below 20 for this amount of time, take one off. And you can do that with every tier of your application. So you have full API programmatic control on both sucking the statistical data, performance data, as well as actually acting on that and doing some kind of scale out action. We are, you know, looking into making that more automated in the future so that you can do it directly from the Windows Azure portal rather than running a separate piece of code. But that nothing to say yet about that.
So a quick follow-up.
Yep.
So if you end up with a denial of service attack,
yes. I see what you're saying. Yeah, that's a good question. I don't have an answer for that one. I'm sure that there's a... the question was if there's a denial of service attack, how do you make sure your auto-scale doesn't scale to infinity and then, you know, your credit card explodes in your pocket?
Yeah.
Yeah, great question. I'm sure that there's some safeguards in place you can put, but I don't know what the things are there. I mean, yeah, that's the important bit, right? Your site never goes down. Yes, sir. Oh, really? So what I would invite you to do, and I invite everyone actually in the room, and I wish there was more people in the room still, but I guess it's my fault, is to come by the Windows Azure booth. And what we have is a series of challenges where we're going to take you through four different challenges, if you will, to do different things on Windows Azure. And there's people there to help you through that process. And you win a prize after you do each one. So the first one is go spin up a VM in Windows Azure. It's the easiest darn thing you ever did. And you get that one, you get a water bottle. And the next one's a little bit harder, and you get some headphones. So, and then at the end, if you get all four of them, you get entered in the raffle, daily raffle for a Trek bike. So there's an Active Directory scenario down there. So I invite you to come down, and the experts with that Active Directory service are down there, and they can help you go through that process, and you can ask them all the questions you have. It's been great.
You mentioned one of the keys to designing apps is state management.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, if I understood your question correctly, how do you manage the different configurations between running locally versus running live in the cloud?
Yeah.
For managing things like session state? What's that?
I don't think I articulated it very well, but it's the whole deploying and using cache management through the different environments.
Right. Right. Exactly. Yeah, you would pull out the two lines of code where you're writing the file to the disk, and instead you would write it to Windows Azure Blob Storage with two different lines of code. That's the main change that you would make in terms of things that you write to disk, you're going to want to write them to Blob Storage. And then all your instances are looking at the same Blob Storage account, and so they can see all that data. And I think going back to your question, there's, you would have to have some kind of, switcher code, and you can have two separate configuration files. I think I showed earlier you can have a cloud configuration file and a local configuration file, so you can say when I'm running locally or on this environment, you can have 10 configuration files if you want, and you can say in this case use whatever, and then when I deploy to the cloud, start using the shared cache role to store session state, and you just configure that.
So the clouds, cache role, that can take place in SQL, that's one of your session.
Yeah, it could. In fact, that's what I would recommend. Yeah, I would recommend that. It's, it's going to be faster for sure than round trip to the database. Yep. All right, one more thing I want to remind everyone of before you leave is that if you're an MSDN subscriber, go activate your Windows Azure. You get, lots of monetary credit now. It's a new system. It's really, really awesome. Talked about it this morning. I'm giving away an Aston Martin at the end of September. So every MSDN subscriber goes and activates their Windows Azure benefit and deploys something. You got to deploy a VM or a website. You're automatically entered into the sweepstakes for a 2013 Aston Martin V8 Vantage. Doesn't matter what it is. Let's go try it. If you already have an account, great question. If you already have an account, you're still eligible. You already have an MSDN. Sorry. You have to already have an MSDN subscription. And even if you've already activated your Azure before today, you're still eligible. You just have to deploy something between now and September 30. Yes. And official rules and regulations are aka.ms/Azure contest. So please check it out and click the view details. And with that, thank you very much. And I can take more questions at all. Yes, sir. Yes. Yes, you can go now in your account. You can go into your account and see real time what your accrual is. Yes, yes, I should have mentioned that. Yes, everything that's through the portal is available through APIs and through PowerShell, and we have PowerShell commandlets to do everything, almost everything. What this one? aka.ms/AzureContest. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Are they just web and database, or are they connecting to other systems and applications? Okay. Okay. You should look at Windows Azure websites if it's just web and some web services and a database, and it's not connecting back to lots of other systems. Well, over HTTP. And is it